My castaway this week is a singer and an actress, the daughter of a Rosyth docker. She left school with three O-levels and a beautiful voice. But it never occurred to her to use the voice rather than the O-levels until she was offered a short singing engagement which forced her to abandon the day job. She went on to play the lead vocal in Willie Russell's play John, Paul, George, Ringo and Bert, and 8 years later won an award for her performance in his Blood Brothers. She's had hit singles, January, February, and I Know Him So Well among them, and recently a leading role in ITV's Band of Gold. Sometimes she says, I can't believe I made it over the wall with the dogs barking at my heels, and they still haven't caught me. She is Barbara Dixon. Does that mean, Barbara, that you don't feel you deserve your success, or that you just still can't believe it's happened to you?
I think a bit of both, actually. I think that being Scots and with my mother having a Jewish background, I've got this extraordinary dichotomy, you know, which is that in Scotland it's not encouraged for you to show off. You shouldn't show off. And yet my mother's Liverpool background is, if you got it, flaunt it, you know. So I'm stuck in the middle of that.
But it's also that kind of feeling, is it, that kind of girls from Dunfermline born in the baby boom just don't make it big?
Well, no, I mean, I wanted to be a film star when I was seven, and I thought, I can't be a film star because I live in Dunfermline.
But you always had the voice. Did that not mark you out from an early age?
Yes, but I didn't use the voice. I used to sing in the bathroom with a sort of tube of toothpaste for a microphone. But I didn't actually use it because I was very, very shy, and I still am, actually. I don't like showing off, and I find it difficult to walk into a room full of people who turn round and say, oh, look, there's Barbara Dixon. I just, my legs go.
Well, it's difficult when you're giving a concert in the Albert Hall.
Well, that's different because I'm working then and I've got my sort of Barbara Dixon hat on. But when I'm being myself, I find it quite difficult. I think a lot of people in my profession are like that.
But the voice must have marked you out at school.
Yes, it did. I mean, I had a music teacher when I got to secondary school, and everybody in my class knew I could sing really well, and I'd started to play the guitar then, and I'd given up piano lessons. A music teacher said, well, maybe, which I thought in retrospect is a bit insulting, but he said, well, maybe you haven't got the best voice in the school, Barbara, but you've certainly got the loudest. And I thought, charming.
But very were you nice. Encouraged? I mean, school and parents, did they say, look, you can really do something with this voice, or was it just a little talent our Barbara had?
I think it was really a little talent. I think that because of my background, it was never even possible that I would become a very famous person because of the way I could sing. My music teacher used to encourage me to sing folk music. You know, he used to play Kingston Trio and stuff like that. My love of folk music, I think, comes from that time, stems from them.
But the idea that you'd make a living out of it was anathema.
No, not at all. I wanted to be a school teacher, and I didn't do well enough at school to be a teacher. And then I thought, oh, cripes, I'm going to have to do something else here. So I went into the civil service.
We shall hear more about that in a minute. Tell me about your first record.
Well, when I was very young, I went to see a film at Rosyth Picture House. My mum took me to see Doris Day and Calamity Jane. And because she was being such a tough, sort of spunky girl, I thought, girls can do anything if they could just be like Doris Day.
Oh, the Deadwood stages are rolling on over the plains, with the curtains flapping and the driver a-slapping the reins. A beautiful sky, a wonderful day. Whip, crack away, whip, crack away, whip, crack away.
Doris Day and the Deadwood stage. The other part of the story of the early Barbara Dixon that's always stressed is that you were no great looker. But to my mind, it was actually that absence of obvious glamour when you sat at the back of the stage in John, Paul, George, Ringo and Bert with your glasses sliding off your nose. You know, don't you think that was the attraction, that you were what you were, which was a kind of original bit of casting?
I think I looked like a bit of a sort of serious blue stockingy folk singer type, which was precisely what I was, and therefore perfect casting. They couldn't have found anybody more suitable to look like that than me.
But you did keep propping the glasses,
yes,
back
exactly,
up on your nose the whole time.
I think it's something to do with my general kind of lack of confidence as a youngster. I mean, you know, that's, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody, but because of my background and because of the sort of person I was, I think I've got a huge ego, but was embarrassed about it, so covered it up with all this sort of slightly namby-pambiness. And as I denied the fact that I was a sort of sexual animal, I think. I mean, I certainly was a sexual animal, but I think I thought you should never look like one. And also there was all that stuff about, you know, if you look cheap, then you make the wrong kind of statements. And what was, I didn't really know what looking cheap was, but too much leg and too much makeup and all that stuff. So I went completely the opposite way.
But it was a great hit, the show, and it transferred from Liverpool. I think it was at the Everyman, wasn't it? And then it came into the West End. But was it a calculation on your part? I mean, was it something that you decided, if I do this show, I can transfer from folk into the mainstream?
No, absolutely not. I had to be absolutely backed into a corner to do that show because I was so scared and nervous of being a failure in it. And my whole life, whenever I've done anything important, I've had to be backed into a corner by whoever I really respect who's said to me, if you don't do this, you're a fool. Bernard Theobald has played a massive part in my working life, and I've worked with him since 1972.
And he's your manager.
He was the man, yes, who said, you've got to do this. You're mad if you don't do it. Willie Russell said, please, please, please do it.
And this was because Willie Russell had heard you sing in folk clubs.
Yeah,
we knew each other. In Runcorn or somewhere.
Well, he used to run his college folk club in Liverpool, and he used to go to the Mitre, and I used to sing there. So he'd heard me sing folk songs.
And he knew it was, again, it was this voice. He wanted the voice.
That was a marvellous idea. I mean, I have to say, that was a stroke of genius that Willie Russell said, I don't want to have a person who will be compared to the Beatles or a band of four guys sort of singing very adequately Beatles songs on the side of the stage. His idea was to, if I did it, it would never be compared to the original. It would be like a sort of new approach. And it really paid off because all the audiences who ever saw that show in London and in Liverpool said, isn't the music good? And it was so simple and direct because that's all I knew.
Record number two.
Classical music hasn't played an enormous part in my life, but I do love Vaughan Williams because it just strikes a chord. I think it's something to do with it being rather like folk music to me. It touches a chord with me, and I don't think he ever did anything better than the Fantasia on the theme by Thomas Tallis.
Part of Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis, played by the New Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. I'd like to hear a bit more about your background before we trace more of the career, Barbara. Father was a docker, and you began life in a prefab in something called Dollytown in the estate, I think. Lots of post-war flat roof prefabs. People remember them 50 years on with great fondness. What was the reality like?
Well, I remember it being a very happy house, and I speak to my mother, and my mother said that she thought it was the happiest house that we ever lived in as a family, although it was very, very small. I left there when I was about 7 and went to live in a modern council house, which was a sort of upstairs and downstairs. But my mother, I remember, I think one absorbs stuff from one's parents, and so much of what my mother felt at the time, I talk about as being my feelings. I don't know if everybody's like this, but I recall that she said she didn't like the new house in Ockle Terrace, which was brand spanking new. And I don't think I liked it because of that.
And was there music in these houses?
Absolutely. My mother had Beethoven's Fifth on 78s. But she also had light music. She had a lot of Deanna Durbin and film music and Bing Crosby and people like that. But she also listened to the light programme. So there was current music, light music, popular in the 50s happening when I was a young child in that little house in Dollytown.
So you in turn absorbed all of that?
Absolutely.
But you obviously had a natural talent for music. Didn't you play the piano at the age of 4?
Yes, I did. I used to go to piano lessons, and I kept at piano lessons when we moved to Dunfermline when I was 7. I kept at them until I was about 12. But I really, my heart was never in piano lessons. I just didn't like that.
I thought you played piano at Sunday school.
Well, I played the piano for the Sunday school at St Ninian's Church, yes, but I think we all went to Sunday school and I could play the piano, so I was the one designated to play for the hymns. I was about probably between 12 and 14, the little feather strip hat that we all wore, and a sort of high, little round-collared coat, very long, and nylon stockings and fairly respectable low shoes. I just thought I was so grown up going to church on a Sunday.
So when did you switch to the guitar?
About that time, actually. I got a guitar from somebody I knew locally, which cost virtually nothing. And then I went on a school trip when I was 14 to Spain, and I bought a guitar for £3 in La Coruña. And brought it back, and it was a proper Spanish guitar, you know, with a wide neck. So I used to play that, and basically I never really put a guitar down from then on.
But no lessons, you just took
it? I did try lessons for a while, but I didn't really want to learn to play Satin Doll when I was 25, you know. I mean, that wasn't quite what I wanted to do. I wanted to accompany songs.
So at what point did you sit down in front of an audience, a very discerning audience, in a folk club and perform to them? And what did you play?
I think I was 17. I was definitely underage, and I was in the folk club in the local pub with some of my friends. It's emblazoned on my brain forever. I just remember the man at the front, whose name was John Watt, standing up and saying, "Does anybody want to sing?" Because that's what they did. I mean, you were encouraged to join in, and it was so informal. And my friend said, "Yes, she will." And they volunteered me to go up, and I went up because I felt too much of a fool not to. I wasn't quite smart enough to get out of it. And I wanted deeply to do it. But I was so tremendously nervous. I got up and I had to sit on a stool. I borrowed a guitar and I sang a song called The Cruel War. That was off a Peter, Paul and Mary album. And I crossed my legs. And because of where my legs were crossed, my bottom leg holding the guitar was shaking so much that I just, you know, that the guitar was sort of virtually falling out of my hands with nerves and fear and embarrassment.
Record number three.
Well, all during this time in my life, I used to go to festivals and listen to a lot of singers. And there were still, in the early 60s, some of the great traditional singers in Scotland were still alive. Jimmy Macbeth was a brilliant sort of slightly music hall orientated traditional singer who used to sing loads and loads of funny songs. But I've chosen a song of his that's not funny, called Tramps and Hawkers.
Come on, ye tramps and hawkers, ye gatherers of blood. The tramps the country rule and rule, come listen in and all. I'll tell to you a roving tale and sights that I have seen. It's far up into the snowy north and south by Great Negreen. Oft times I've laughed into my cell when trudging on the road, with a bog a blow upon my back, my pieces bronze a tone. With lumps of cakes and tatty scones and cheese and broxy ham, it's ne thinking where I'm coming fae, nor where I'm going to gang.
Jimmy Macbeth and Tramps and Hawkers. So folk singing by night, Barbara Dixon, but clerking by day in the local registrar's office. What did you do?
Well, I started off in Rosyth Dockyard, working in the naval stores department, then in the personnel department. And then I asked for a transfer to Edinburgh. And that's where I was, of course, when Denmark loomed large.
Now tell me about Denmark. This is the big break, the big offer.
Well, what happened was there was a place in the Tivoli Gardens called the Vice Versa House, and it's a musical venue. And all through the 60s, they used to have foreign acts would come and sing for maybe a season of 1 or 2 weeks in the summer. And I was invited to go there, and I thought, brilliant idea. But I was, it is extraordinary, really. I was very cautious. I thought, now, if I go to Denmark, I'm going to come back, I'm going to have no money, I'm going to have to be on the dole. And in fact, that happened. But I asked the civil service if they would let me go for something like 4 weeks, 5 weeks. And they said, no. I said, can I have unpaid leave? No, there's no such thing. So I thought, I've got to resign. And that was a bold move, really.
Your parents must have thought you were mad.
My father thought I was mental. He really did. He said, giving up that pension... And, of course, he's completely right. No, I could have done with it, but... He said, giving up a pension for something, you know, as flagrantly stupid as being a singer for a couple of years, he thought, was madness. And I did it anyway.
But after that, after you came back, you were then cut loose. You were on to singing as a career. And I know you went off to England, which must have seemed like a long, long way away. But for 5 years, really, you toured the northern clubs, didn't you? You and your guitar and your suitcase.
That's correct,
It
yeah.
must have been a pretty lonely, miserable business on occasions.
Well, yes, that... I do have happy memories of the music I was singing and playing, and I was gaining confidence all the time, and I had to do about an hour and 10 minutes of music each night whenever I was playing, so I had to learn a lot of songs, and I had come on enormously. But I have to give credit for an awful lot of influence over the way I developed as a singer during those years. It was really down to a friend of mine called Archie Fisher, who's a very well-known and respected and rather eclectic songwriter and singer of traditional songs in Scotland. And he kind of took me under his wing and helped me enormously. But what folk clubs taught me was the ability to communicate with an audience. People say to me, God, you talk to people as if you're in a little room. And I say, yes, I think I am. Because of folk clubs. I mean, if I'm in the Albert Hall, I do links into songs like I'm in a folk club. Because it's what I learned to do.
Record number 4.
Well, when I was in John Paul, George, Ringo and Bert, somebody told me there was this American band called Little Feet had emerged, and people were and read great reviews. And I went round the corner to the record store in Shaftesbury Avenue and bought this record, and I took it home and I put the record on, and this is what I heard.
There was a woman in Georgia, didn't feel just right. She had fever all day and chilled the night. Now things got worse, yes, a serious bind. In times like this, it takes a man to style like getting out of a vine. A doctor of the heart and a doctor of the mind.
Little Feet and Rock and Roll Doctor. Now, something happened to Barbara Dixon, the bespectacled folk singer, when she came down to London in the mid-70s. A metamorphosis took place and she turned into a different person overnight. Tell me about it.
I became a beautiful swan. Hadn't you noticed? I made an album while I was in John Paul, George, Ringo and Bert. And it was to be the first pop album I'd really done. And it was going to be called Answer Me. And the single of Answer Me had been done. And I had to do the cover. I'd never had a posh record cover done. And I went along to a studio in South Kensington. And Lawrence Zatecki was the photographer. And I went into this rather lovely studio. And there was a bloke in the corner who was a very, very interesting little Frenchman called Régis. And Régis did a massive makeover on me, lasting about 2 hours. He cut my hair, which was sort of long and sort of not quite wavy, not quite straight. He permed it into a sort of elliptical kind of shape, so it looked rather kind of Art Nouveau. And he made up my face. I got dressed up in these rather lovely 1920s kind of diaphanous frocks and went out there with little snakeskin shoes on and had my picture taken. And left the studio a different woman.
Without the glasses?
Yes, I'd already got contact lenses about 2 weeks before this, but with the contact lenses and the face and the hair, I suddenly thought that I was whoever was currently the sex symbol at the time.
But this was more than a makeover for the day. You hung on to this. You knew then how to make yourself.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, I had the hairstyle was permanent. There it was. It had come out of a bottle, but it was there. And it made a fantastic difference to the way I looked as well as the way I felt. And it gave me a physical confidence, which I think I'd never, ever had.
And then you became a pop star because yes. You had this hit, Answer Me, which you had done the cover for yes. in 76. And then there was another suitcase in another hall, I think the year after, 77.
That's right.
So you transferred into pop. Is it true, tell me this, is it true that you turned down the lead role in Evita about then?
No, I didn't turn it down. I went to see Tim and Andrew, and we sang. I remember singing
Rice and Lloyd Webber.
Yes, and I went to sing one of the up-tempo songs from Evita in Andrew's flat in Eaton Square, and I knew, and they knew, that this was not for me. It's too big. I'm not that sort of singer, really. I'm not really a show singer. And I knew, as I was trying to sing it or doing it, that it wasn't for me.
Which and one was it?
I can't remember which song. It was one of the big belty things, but I'm no Ethel Merman. That's not my kind of thing. And I wasn't happy with it, and they weren't happy with what I was doing with it. But the song, the mistress's song, Another Suitcase in Another Hall, was, of course, ideal, and it proved to be a great success. It was a big hit.
And Elaine Page, of course, became Evita. You did, though, turn down Chess, didn't you, some years later, after you'd recorded I Know Him So Well with Elaine?
Yes. Well, I mean, the part of the Russian's wife was very small, and I'm not being an egomaniac here, but I didn't think at that point in my life, having done Blood Brothers and won an Olivier Award for it, there was any point in me going in, although I would have spent a lot of time with Elaine, which would have been great. But I wouldn't have liked to have been there to sing a couple of songs. It would not have given me enough to do. So I didn't want to do it, but that was no reflection on the piece because I just love Chess. I love the music from Chess.
More music.
I have been deeply in love with James Taylor since about 1967. When I went to Denmark, I stole a friend's album, Sweet Baby James. I put it in the bottom of my guitar case so the corners were all sort of curled up, and gave it back to him about 2 months later. So it was so difficult for me to go to a desert island and not take something of James Taylor's. And I just, because it's so, this is so sexy and so appealing, this song, I just thought this had to be the one. It's called Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight.
Do me wrong, do me right, tell me lies but hold me tight, save your goodbyes for the morning light, but don't let me be lonely tonight.
James Taylor and Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight. Blood Brothers was a great West End success in the early 80s. You played Mrs. Johnston, the poverty-stricken mother who's forced to give away one of her sons. That was really your first acting role, wasn't it, although you sang as well?
Yes, it was absolutely my first acting role. And once again, I had to be sort of, you know, stood up against a wall and threatened with a lingering death if I didn't do it. This is what I'm like.
But it was Willie Russell doing the bullying again.
Willie Russell and Chris Bond, who is a wonderful theatre director and writer, he was going to direct Blood Brothers. And after Bernard saying to them, I give up, you know, if you can get her to do it, you know, all that stuff. And they both came to London to see me. And I said, oh, I don't think I can do it, I don't know. And they sat down and I read a bit of it. And Chris Bond said, yeah, you can do it. I'll make sure you do it.
I can see that that's a big jump, though, because suddenly you don't have the piano or the guitar between you and the audience. I mean, you are actually on there alone with your hands free, moving about, aren't you?
Exactly.
That's a very different experience,
and
different performance.
It's very, very different acting to singing. A lot of actors can sing because they can sell a song in the performance, but hardly any singers can act.
Mm.
I wanted to get it right so much because it was such a good piece of theatre and I believed completely in the story. And you see, if it's too show busy, it doesn't work for me. It has to be bleak and Liverpudlian and to do justice to the sadness and the toughness of what Willie actually wrote in that script. He's a wonderful writer.
Now, these days it's Taggart and Band of Gold, but they were a long time coming, really, those parts, weren't they, for somebody who'd won a Sweat Award for Best Actress. Why do you think it took so long? I mean, nearly 10 years, really.
Well, I haven't a clue.
The office came.
I haven't a clue. I was desperate to do more acting, but I think, you know, if people think of you as being a singer,
you can't. But they're tough parts that you get, tough characters. I mean, from Mrs. Johnston to certainly Anita in the Band of Gold, kind of tart with a heart. Well, she keeps the brothel, doesn't she, for the prostitutes. It's very interesting that you get cast in those sorts of roles when your image, your recording image, is one is very sort of middle-of-the-road, girl-next-door, gentle.
I'm not really like that, you see. I'd much rather do the sort of tough things. the press and television, certainly light entertainment, just emasculates everybody. So you are tended to be seen as a rather anodyne character. I've never been quite as much the girl next door as people have thought of me as being.
Record number six.
My children have become devoted to an album that we have at home, which is a collection of the old BBC children's favourites. And this, politically incorrect as it could ever be, I mean, couldn't find a more politically incorrect song than this, is Charlie Drake singing My Boomerang Won't Come Back.
My boomerang won't come back. My boomerang won't come back. I've waved the thing all over the place. Practiced till I was black in the face. I'm a big disgrace, the Aborigine race. My boomerang won't come back. I can ride a kangaroo.
Yeah, yeah.
Make kinkajou stew.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll make disgrace the Aborigine race. My boomerang won't come back.
Charlie Drake and My Boomerang Won't Come Back. The other important transition you've made in your life, Barbara, and you did it relatively late, is from single woman to wife and mother. You married at 36. Why did you leave it so late?
Because I just never really found anybody that was a suitable husband and father. I mean, it's as simple as that. I didn't really want to get married. I wanted to get married when I was very, very young a couple of times, but fortunately I didn't do it. I say fortunately because I really mean that. And when I met my husband, it was in when I was started in Blood Brothers. And I didn't really, when I met him, I didn't think of him as being immediately as being a sort of suitable partner for me, because he's 11 years younger than me. And I thought, well, that'll never work. But, I mean, we've been married 11 years and we're still together, so it's worked so far.
And you've had three babies, Colm, who's now 8, Gabriel, 6, and Archie, 4. Which is a lot to produce and manage in the second half of your 30s and your early 40s. What's been the effect of all that domesticity on your professional life?
It's been a very broadening experience. Having children is a very broadening experience. You, as a person, you grow. I mean, some people don't want to have children. That's their decision. But I did want to have children, and my life has been changed forever. Me, the person, Barbara Dixon, the private citizen. As an artist, I'm not sure whether I've changed that much or whether I would have been much the same as an artist if I'd had no children. All it does mean is, of course, I'm a lot more worried all the time, because I'm worried about whether everybody's okay if I'm not there. And that has been, I suppose, a negative influence, because I tend to be more concerned about things that are nothing to do with my work when I'm not at home.
Has it made you less ambitious, perhaps?
It's easy to think that children would rob you of your ambition, because your ambitions would be fulfilled by children. But I think, basically, I'm a rather dissatisfied customer, and I have itchy feet. And my feet itch so much that I have to be doing something that satisfies my ego as well as my biological clock.
Record number seven.
Well, my favourite songwriter, and I've got a lot of favourite songwriters, is Randy Newman, who's an American and a brilliant lyricist, very important lyrics. But I've chosen a tune of his which doesn't say anything very important at all. It's about when he was sent to New Orleans from Los Angeles as a little child, and his observations are fantastic. It's called The Dixie Flyer.
Got all the Dixie Flyer.
Randy Newman and Dixie Flyer. You say, Barbara, that acting is now important to you, but I still have the impression that you're most at home with an audience, really, singing, whether it's at the Albert Hall or in the Café Royal or in a provincial leisure centre. There's a sense of comfort when you do that. Is that what you feel, that you're at home, at one, you're where you began and where you belong?
It's also where you find out if it works. If you go to somewhere and sing and play a concert with a really good band and the audience think it's fantastic, and you've done really challenging material, which I do, and sing everything from sort of theatre songs to folk music in my show, and the people have enjoyed it, then I know it works, and I might as well keep doing it as long as I can sing and get away with it.
What would you rather have next? Would you rather be offered, you know, a really big musical, the equivalent of Evita, or would you like a good, solid, down-to-earth cameo role, maybe, in a play?
I like television because every day is something different, and I know that's a very undisciplined thing to say, but that really does affect me. And I am going to do a musical in the West End next year, but it's totally different again because I don't want to do a big production musical. It's not what I like. I'm not that kind of artist. I'm more sort of Brecht than Broadway, I think. I like more sort of tough things and with sadness in them because that's my vocal style. I mean, I am still basically a singer of folk songs who just sings theatre songs in a kind of, I suppose, distinctive but unknowing way. Last record. Well, because I'm going to be on my own on this island and I'm going to want to make some sort of, I think, some alcohol out of the coconuts, I'm going to have to ferment something because I wouldn't be able to stand it, and I want to escape in my own head for a little while. I'm going to have to get something wild to dance to because I want to dance on the shore, and I thought I would take the Pogues and the Dubliners.
On the 4th of July 1806 we set sail from the sweet cove of Cork. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. 'Twas a wonderful craft, she was rigged for a laugh. You know how the wild wind drove her. She stood several blasts, she had 27 masts, and they called her the Irish Rover.
The Pogues and the Dubliners and the Irish Rover, good for a laugh on your desert island, but what's the one, if you could only take one, that you choose?
I've got to take James Taylor because I am deeply in love with James Taylor.
And it's good for a cry, I suppose.
God, it's so sad. I'm going to be so lonely with that. Don't let me be lonely tonight, and I'm just going to be sitting there with the sound of the waves.
What about your book?
There's a very big collection of English and Scottish popular ballads collected by F.J. Child. He's long dead, sadly. But it was the most wonderful and definitive collection of the ballads of England and Scotland. And some American, I think in the 60s or 70s, found all the tunes that go with all the ballads and put them together. And what I'd like to do is just to have that collection so that I could learn these fantastic ballads like Long Lankin, so that when I come back, if I am rescued, I would know all of that stuff. I'd be like Professor Dixon of the School of Scottish Studies.
And what about your luxury?
Can I have a very large set of heated rollers? Can I have solar power?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I must have heated rollers. My hair is like the bane of my life.
Barbara Dixon, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.